I'm Dr. Santi Bhagat. I'm a physician and a mother of a young adult with a chronic condition. And I've spent the last 20 years studying and analyzing policies and systems of care for young adults with chronic conditions. 1 in 4 young adults in the U.S., approximately 20 million people are living with a chronic medical condition. And that's a staggering number that our society just can't afford to ignore. There isn't a place to go to for these people. There is not only no system of care, no policies, there's no place for them. That's what the Invisible Wave podcast is. It's about building relationships and community. It's actually a part of health in addition to mental and physical health. That's what we're doing here. We are bringing people together to share what we know and to learn as a community from each other and to make the invisible visible. Listen to the Invisible Wave podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Everybody, and welcome to Care Talk. My name is Laura Packard, and we're here to answer your American healthcare and health insurance questions. And today we have a special guest, Ianthe Metzger, the Senior Director of Advocacy Communications at Planned Parenthood Federation of America and Planned Parenthood Action Fund, to talk about reproductive healthcare, what's happened over the past several years, and what could happen next year, and how it will affect patients. So welcome, Ianthe.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
So tell us, people may have heard there was an important Supreme Court decision a couple years ago, and a lot has changed, but things have been changing even before that Supreme Court decision. So tell us what happened.
Yes. So, I mean, as you mentioned, you know, 2022 was a really big year for abortion rights. That was the year that the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, which said that there was a federal constitutional right to abortion. And, you know, we had that right for 50 years. But, you know, I think people need to understand that this didn't happen overnight. You know, this was a coordinated, well-funded attack by the opposition to get Roe v. Wade overturned. And that was a monumental precedent that we lost. You know, I think that the majority of Americans, as we've seen in the past election and in elections previously, do support abortion rights and do not think that the government should be involved in people's medical decisions. But we have seen even before Roe was overturned that, you know, the anti-abortion movement worked really hard to chip away at Roe, whether that was passing small restrictions that made it harder for clinics to even be open. You know, there are these things called targeted regulations on abortion providers, where it would require providers to have hallways that were a certain size or have us be within a certain distance to a hospital unit, which are all completely medically unnecessary restrictions. And those all made it really difficult for many providers to even function. So even before Roe, in many states, you know, abortion was functionally inaccessible to many people. But, you know, overturning Roe v. Wade 2 years ago was the culmination of their effort. But it also was the beginning for, in many cases, you know, they were never going to stop with just Roe being overturned. You know, they are still coming to ban abortion nationwide. They're coming for birth control. They're coming for fertility treatments. And so we need to remain really vigilant and really clear-eyed in our mission to make sure that everybody, no matter who they are, where they're from, is able to maintain that bodily autonomy and able to make decisions about if, when, and how to start and grow their families. Mm-hmm.
Can you tell us more about abortion and who gets abortions? You know, who is facing the consequences of these decisions?
Yeah, so I mean, abortion is a very basic part of reproductive healthcare. You know, 1 in 4 women before she is 45 will need an abortion in her lifetime. It is a very common medical procedure. It spans, you know, demographics, you know, socioeconomic statuses, race, gender. It really is a procedure that every woman who is interested in becoming pregnant or not being pregnant, of course, will face in her lifetime. And it's really important that you know, your circumstances don't dictate whether you can get the healthcare that you need. You know, we do talk a lot about, you know, emergency abortion care as well. And, you know, people who have very wanted pregnancies who, you know, face really challenging situations where abortion care is the only option, you know, when you miscarry or have a stillborn, like, you know, when that happens, abortion care is what happens after those. And I think that people kind of want to separate those two things out or make a distinction, but it's the same medication. It is the same procedure. But even still, you know, sometimes, you know, you get pregnant and you don't want to be pregnant, and it's up to you and your family what makes the most sense for you. And it's important that we respect those decisions and make sure that people can make them without interference from politicians who don't know their specific situation.
Can you tell me more about stories have come out about women in Texas and in Georgia that have died because they didn't have access to abortion care? Can you talk more about what these abortion bans, how they're making doctors afraid to practice medicine?
Yeah, so big shout out to ProPublica that has done really, really great reporting on women in Georgia and Texas that you mentioned who have died because they weren't able to access abortion care, died preventable deaths. They simply just needed to get a D&E, which is a very specific abortion procedure, or, you know, something like that to be with us today. And they weren't able to access that care. I mean, in many of these states now, you know, where there are bans, and there are 21 states that have banned all or some abortions, doctors, they're often afraid to provide care, even when there are exceptions for health of the mother or for rape and incest. Sometimes those exceptions are really, really hard for people to access. And doctors, you know, they are, if it's a law that requires, like in Georgia, there be a quote unquote fetal heartbeat, meaning that you can't have an abortion if there is a pulse on for your fetus, that can be really challenging for doctors when, you know, it's very clear that the mother is not doing well, and the only cure is an abortion. And you know, in states like Georgia, it makes it impossible for them to get that care. You know, it means that doctors have to consult with their lawyers or consult with, you know, their advisory board at their hospital before they can get access to an abortion. And that is just precious time that, you know, is being wasted when there's a patient who is in dire need of healthcare. But, you know, we've put these laws have put doctors in an impossible situation. You know, many times they are facing jail time, losing their license, extraordinary fines if they do provide an abortion that the state deems was illegal, quote unquote. And so it's really, really difficult and really sad that we've put them in this position, because it's understandable why they would be scared to provide care. But again, that's why doctors should be the only ones who have a say in with their patients and the healthcare that they provide, that it shouldn't be up to politicians, because each pregnancy is different. Each abortion is different. These all require different sort of treatments. And we need to make sure that we have the right people making those decisions.
So what you're saying is that doctors and patients should be making important healthcare decisions and not lawyers and politicians deciding, and people are dying because of these choices.
Yes, exactly. And it seems it should feel very straightforward, but it's not. You know, this is an issue that I think a lot of people really have a lot of strong feelings about. But at the end of the day, we know that the majority of Americans believe what we're saying. They believe that it should be up to doctors and patients, not politicians and the government.
And can you talk some more about what we might see next year? You know, we've already seen, you said, over 20 states have some form of restrictions on abortion and abortion care. Can you talk more about what we could see next year, including, as you mentioned earlier, attacks on birth control, infertility treatments, as, you know, this is just the start.
This is definitely just the start. And so at the federal level, you know, under the Trump administration, we could see a number of things. Trump, I will say, has said how he will not sign a national abortion ban. We will hold him to that. But, you know, he also is the same person who appointed the justices to the Supreme Court that did overturn Roe v. Wade. So grain of salt with all of that. But in terms of what we can see, we could see the federal government moving to enforce something called the Comstock Act, which is a law from 150 years ago that banned the shipping or mailing of things like that, any that would be considered obscene or lewd, like contraception, abortion pills. And, you know, anti-abortion folks want to revive this law from 150 years ago to say that abortion is banned right now. So they can enforce that through the Department of Justice, and that would be devastating and be tantamount to a national abortion ban. So we're really worried about that. We also know that, you know, there are a number of folks that Donald Trump is already nominating to his cabinet, many of whom do not support abortion rights, and they can do work to restrict access to care that way. He can also nominate judges and justices who are not supportive of abortion rights as well. So we're looking out for those things. And there could also be cuts to really, really critical family planning programs, like Title 10 that, you know, allows health centers to provide birth control and STI testing and other essential reproductive health care to people mostly with low incomes. There can be cuts to those programs, and that would be, of course, incredibly devastating. And that's just at the federal level. You know, at the state level, you know, with legislative sessions restarting in January, we could see many states move to restrict travel to different states to get care. So states with bans can, you know, block you from getting out of your state to get an abortion somewhere else. We can see a lot of restrictions on people who help others obtain abortion. So we call them support bans, where you have your support network and they can target people in that network and prevent you from getting or target them so that they, you know, get punished for helping you get that care. So that's something that we're really nervous about. And we can also see a lot more restrictions on mifepristone, which is the abortion pill that is used in 2/3 of abortion. The state of Louisiana this year actually made mifepristone, they classify it as a controlled substance. So there are a lot more rules around it, and it makes it a lot harder for people in emergencies to access that pill when necessary. And we expect many other states to do the same thing. And that would, you know, be a huge detriment, of course. And also just defunding attempts for Planned Parenthoods and other health providers, so they are not able to provide healthcare beyond abortion as well. So there's a lot that we're facing next year. But, you know, we are at Planned Parenthood very committed to fighting for our patients and doing what we can to beat back these attacks and make sure that people can get the care that they need.
And I think some people that maybe have never been to a Planned Parenthood don't really understand all of the care that you offer. So can you talk a little bit about what Planned Parenthood does for people that have insurance and people that don't?
Yeah, so I mean, Planned Parenthood is the nation's largest provider of sexual and reproductive health care. We proudly provide abortion in states where it is still legal, but we do way more than that. And we have health centers in every state, nearly 600 across the country, mostly in communities that have no other provider, communities with people with low incomes, communities with people of color. So we really do provide care for a lot of marginalized folks. And, you know, beyond abortion, that is birth control, STI treatment and testing, cancer screenings, pap smears. So very, very essential reproductive health care. And we serve more than 2 million patients annually across the country. And in many of these areas, as I mentioned, we're the only providers in those communities. And, you know, there are threats to shut us attacks to shut us down or defund us, and that would be detrimental because, you know, we are a really, really key part of the healthcare infrastructure across the country. And, you know, we've been around for over 100 years, and we are continuing to do the work necessary to make sure that we can get care to patients and patients to care.
So what happens if Planned Parenthood closes or leaves town and there's no other provider for reproductive healthcare? What happens to people in that community?
Yeah, that is the question that we are all, you know, scared to answer. But that is a reality that we're facing. You know, that would mean that people would have to travel hundreds of miles to get healthcare in many situations, or they would, you know, not get healthcare at all. Because we know that the current ecosystem cannot absorb, and especially in rural areas, cannot absorb the patients for Planned Parenthood. We know that we do a lot of sex education work as well. That is a key part of, you know, making sure that people can live safe and free lives, and that will all also be wiped away. So there are a lot of there's a lot that would be lost with that. And again, that's 2 million patients that we see across the country that would not have anywhere to go. And in many cases, we do, you know, serve people with low incomes who don't have other who use Medicaid and other providers like that, and who will not have access to care otherwise. So you're definitely looking at like a public health crisis if all those people have nowhere to go if Planned Parenthood is shut down or defunded.
So if people are listening and paying attention right now and they want to do something to make sure that their local Planned Parenthood gets the funding for cancer screenings and STI treatments and all of the services you provide, what should people be doing to show their support for your work, and how can they keep updated with all these fights?
Yes, yeah, so definitely look up the Planned Parenthood in your community. That we have 49 affiliates that run nearly 600 health centers across the country. Would definitely encourage folks to find the one in their community that serves their community. You know, these are nonprofit health centers, so you know, we also would encourage people to donate if they're able to volunteer if they can, and to just, continue telling their stories. You know, I think a big part of this fight as well is really making sure that people understand, what Planned Parenthood means to them, like what it means to access this healthcare. And if you are somebody who's gotten an abortion, telling your story, telling about, sharing why that was important to you, the difference that it made in your life really means a lot. And I think that when we do that, we destigmatize abortion care. We show people that this is something that everybody or that many people will experience in their lifetime. But yes, in terms of supporting Planned Parenthood, I would definitely encourage folks to look for one of their local community, donate, volunteer, share their story, and just continue talking to people about this, because I think reproductive health care in general is still very much hush hush. And we need to make sure that we're all talking about it openly, because we all need it and we all need to be open about it.
Thank you so much, Anthi, for joining us today, and keep fighting for all of our reproductive healthcare needs next year.
Thanks, Laura. Great to be here.
And now we're going to answer some viewer questions on health insurance and healthcare. And our first question is about open enrollment. So open enrollment for the Affordable Care Act is still going on right now. And if people go to healthcare.gov to pick out a plan, what are some tips to pick out the best plan for their family? Welcome, Louise from healthinsurance.org.
Thank you so much, Laura. It's a pleasure to be here. So if you are shopping in the marketplace for health insurance for 2025, do keep in mind that in most states, the December 15th is your deadline to select a plan that'll start on January 1st. If you enroll between December 16th and January 15th in most states, your coverage won't take effect till February. So we do have just a little over a week now left, just a little over 2 weeks left to get that sorted out. So if you are looking at all of the plans, in most states, the default, it will just show you the plans in order of their premiums. You'll see the cheapest premiums first and then scroll through to the most expensive ones. Depending on where you live, there might be 15 plans available. There might be well over 100. So it really varies from one area to another. The first thing to know is you do not have to do this by yourself. You can get help from a broker or a navigator in your area, and it's free. You don't pay anything for that assistance. Healthcare.gov has a find local help tool, and the states that don't use healthcare.gov that run their own marketplace, they all have similar tools where you can find, you put in your zip code and it will show you assisters in your area who can help you figure all this out. But in terms of just what you're wanting to look for to narrow this down, the premium does need to be something you can afford, the monthly amount that you have to pay. Most folks do qualify for premium subsidies that can offset a large chunk or even sometimes all of the premium you would have to pay for at least some plans. But once you know what your subsidy amount is, you need to look and make sure that you can afford the amount of the plan you're looking for. After that, you're going to want to look at total out-of-pocket costs, not just the deductible. Some plans will have a low deductible, but maybe higher total out-of-pocket costs. So you need to keep that whole big picture in mind. You want to make sure that any doctors that you need to see are in network, and that any prescription drugs you take are covered under the plan, because different plans cover different drugs, and different plans have different provider networks. And the provider network can be different for a company's individual market plans versus their employer-sponsored plans. So you don't want to assume anything. Even if you've had coverage from a job with a certain insurance company and you're looking at that same insurance company's plans in the marketplace, you do need to double check the provider network. Don't assume it's the same as the provider network you had when you were covered with that company's plan in the past. If you're eligible for cost sharing reductions, you need to pick a silver plan in order to get that benefit. Cost sharing reductions are based on your income. It's up to 250% of the poverty level. So for a single person, it's a little more than $37,000 a year. And for a family of four, it's $78,000 a year. But the strongest cost sharing reductions are actually below 200% of the poverty level, which is about $30,000 for a single person and about $62,000-ish for a family of four. If you're below those numbers, you really should be looking at silver plans because your benefits will be so much stronger. And then beyond that, just if you have questions, reach out to a broker or navigator to help you and get it done by December 15th.
Thank you, Louise. And now welcome to Rachel Madley of Center for Health and Democracy. And your first question is about open enrollment for Medicare. Open enrollment for Medicare is almost over. And if you have Medicare or Medicare Advantage, what do you need to do, if anything? And what's the deadline?
Thanks, Laura. Well, Medicare open enrollment is almost over. It goes until this Saturday, December 7th. At midnight Hawaiian Standard Time, which is 5 a.m. Eastern on December 8th. Now, if you're enrolled in traditional Medicare, that will renew automatically. So if you don't want to make any changes, you don't have to do anything. Enrollment in private Medicare Advantage plans, as well as Medicare prescription drug plans, also known as Part D plans, also renews automatically as long as your plan is still being offered by your insurance company. Now, you want to check to make sure that your plan is still being offered because there are a lot of changes in what plans insurance companies are offering in different areas of the country. So make sure to double check that. But if you don't want to change Medicare Advantage or Part D drug plans, again, you don't have to do anything. Now, the open enrollment period is a time where you can also switch from a Medicare Advantage plan to traditional Medicare, or switch from traditional Medicare to an Advantage plan. You can also switch your prescription plan, and you can switch in between Medicare Advantage plans. So this is the one time of year where you can make all of those changes. So make sure you get those in before the deadline on December 7th. And you're probably being inundated with a lot of different TV ads, potentially phone calls, from different insurance companies trying to sell their Medicare Advantage plan. So if you're looking for some unbiased and easily understandable advice on which plan is right for you, you can contact your state health insurance assistance program, also known as your state's SHIP, and they will be able to provide that advice and help you cut through all of the advertisements and information out there and make sure that you get on a Medicare plan that fits all of your needs.
Thank you, Rachel. Our next question came in via voicemail from John, who says that I'm with the Marketplace Health Insurance. I was wondering what kind of benefits I might be able to receive as far as like groceries and gas and stuff. So Louise Norris, can you tell us more about what John is asking about?
Sure. So this is almost certainly in reference to a scam that has been going around the internet for quite some time now. I've written about it on healthinsurance.org. If you go on healthinsurance.org and just search scam in the search bar, you'll find an FAQ that I wrote really explaining all the details on this. But what it pretty much boils down to is scammers misrepresenting the premium subsidies that are available through the marketplace. So these premium subsidies are actually just a tax credit. But instead of being like other tax credits where you can only claim them on your tax return, with the marketplace, you get to take them up front, not paid to you though. They get paid directly to your insurance company. So if you say you qualify for $400 a month in premium tax credits, the government will send that $400 a month straight to your insurance company, which means you pay $400 less for your premiums each month than you would otherwise have to pay. And I just made that number up. Everybody's subsidy amount is different, but you'll oftentimes see this scam labeled as a $6,400 subsidy, for example. And the reason they use that number is because if you look at the average across everyone with marketplace plans in the country, their total subsidy that they get for the whole year averages about $6,400. It's very different from one person to another, but that's the average. That's where they came up with that number. But again, you do not get this money. This money goes straight to your insurance company. It makes it so your policy is cheaper, but it's certainly not money that you can just go and spend on gas and groceries. So if you're seeing, you know, ads talking about a subsidy that you can use for gas and groceries with your health insurance, just buyer beware that that is scammy in terms of how it's being described. The subsidies are available through the marketplace, but they're not going to you. Some marketplace insurance companies do offer rewards programs for things like getting your annual flu shot, getting a physical, stuff like that. They might give you a $25 gift card or a $100 gift card, but it's nothing like the magnitude of the premium subsidies.
So if somebody sees an ad or gets something in the mail about this and it's probably a scam, then they should, they're trying to get this person to switch to their health insurance. They're trying to switch plans or something.
Yeah, it could be, they could be just generating leads, getting you to click through and input your information. So then your information gets sold to people who are marketing coverage. They could be trying to entice you to switch to a plan, and it could be, you know, legitimate plans that are sold on the marketplace. But my feeling is if they're reeling you in with that hook of a $6,400 subsidy, the way that's being portrayed is scammy, and you're probably best to just go to healthcare.gov. Healthcare.gov, if your state doesn't use healthcare.gov, they will direct you to the marketplace in your state. And then you know for sure that you're in the right place. And again, I do have all of those details and where this all came about and stuff on the article I wrote about that subsidy scam.
Thanks for watching out for our audience, Louise. Our next question is for Rachel. Can you explain the various alphabet parts of Medicare, you know, part A, B, C, D, E, F, G, K, all of the letters? What do they mean? What are they?
Definitely. And I often call it an alphabet soup in Medicare. So Medicare Part A covers hospital care, including home health care and hospice care. Medicare Part B is coverage for outpatient care. This is things like doctor's visits. Sometimes it covers drugs that are taken by infusion. So if you're going to the doctor's office to get an infusion as a treatment, that will often be under Medicare Part B. Now, Parts A and B together are often known as traditional Medicare. So if people are enrolled in traditional Medicare, they have Part A and B. Medicare Part D, as in dog, is a private prescription drug coverage plans. Now, these are often used by people in traditional Medicare to make sure that they have their hospital, doctor, and drug coverage all together. Now, Medicare Part C is also known as Medicare Advantage. These are plans that are run by private insurance companies, and they cover the services that are covered under Part A, so those hospital services, as well as Part B, so your doctor's visits and outpatient care. And most times they also cover services that are covered by Part D plans, so the prescription drug plans. So Part C is everything melded together. They're your Medicare Advantage plans, and they do come with a lot of different restrictions that are not present in Medicare Part A and B. Now, there's also a thing called Medicare Supplemental Insurance Plans, also known as Medigap. These also have alphabetical titles, and they are known as Medicare Plans A, B, C, D, F, G, K, L, M, and N. Now, that may seem confusing, but the way that you can tell the difference between a supplemental insurance plan and a core part of Medicare is a supplemental insurance plan will be titled Medicare Plan and then the letter A, B, C, etc. Whereas a core part of Medicare is going to be called Part, so Medicare Part A. Medigap or Medicare supplemental insurance plans are often used by people who are in traditional Medicare, and the supplemental plans will pay any out-of-pocket costs that you may still incur while in traditional Medicare. For example, under Medicare Part A, if you have a hospital stay, you will have a coinsurance payment that you're responsible for. So if you have a Medigap plan, that plan may pay the coinsurance payment for you. Now, that's a lot of information. You can find an explanation of the different parts of Medicare on medicare.gov in case you forget it or you need to reference it again.
Thank you, Rachel. And thank you to everybody who joined us today. If we didn't get to your question yet, be sure to tune in next week. If you have a health insurance or healthcare question, you can text or call it in at 202-838-6837. And we will try to get to your question in future episodes. So thank you so much for joining us for Care Talk. Next week, we'll be back at it with a special guest from Doctors for America that will be talking more about public health issues and what some of the nominees how they could affect our public health in America next year. So thank you very much. This is Care Talk.